Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome to the show. Today we've got a great topic to discuss. And as we get started, let me tell you a little story. A few months ago, my wife and I found out that we're having our third child. We have two girls already. And so whenever someone found out we're having our third child, the conversation was always, "Oh, Luke, you must really want a boy." And to be honest, I really had no preference either way. I was completely content either way. And when we found out that we were having another girl, I was in some way relieved because we've had little girls in our house for the last 5 years, and I love having little girls. It's something I am absolutely blessed by, having two little daughters and a third on the way. So I love having little girls, but the thing I'm horrified about is having teenage daughters, because I know in 11 years from now, my oldest will be 16, and there's going to be that conversation where she says, "Daddy, I met this boy, and I'm bringing him over for dinner." And I'm already dreading that moment. That evening, when I'm sitting in my living room and the doorbell rings and it's some 16-year-old kid who just rang the door, and I get up off the couch, pick up some sort of weapon, and walk to the door. And as I walk to the door, if you have girls, you understand what this feeling is going to be like. If you already have a 16-year-old daughter, you get this. But if you don't and you're just imagine what that person on the other side of the door would be. Imagine the last person you'd want to be on the other side of the door when they're coming over for the first time to say that I'm your daughter's boyfriend. Imagine who the last person you would want to be on the other side of that door is. Well, Jesus tells a story about the Good Samaritan. And he tells a story in which a Jew is going, "That is the absolute worst person. We want to be a hero of the story." It's probably a lot like us today going, "The last person I want on the other side of the door when my daughter brings someone home is the Good Samaritan." It's the Samaritan to the Jews in the first century. Who is that to us today? And I'm wondering who the last person would be. And I think a lot of people might say someone who's a Muslim. I think in our post 9/11 world, a lot of people would think the last person they would want their daughter to bring home is a Muslim. And so that's what I want to talk about today. So I brought in a good friend of mine from Nashville, Tennessee, Mr. Joshua Graves, to the show. So welcome, Josh.
Thank you, Luke.
Josh wrote his doctoral work. He has an ebook now that he published from his doctoral work entitled "Tearing Down the Walls," in which he's examining the relationships between Christianity and Islam in North America. And so he is a great person to talk about on this very subject. So Joshua, thank you for joining us and being a part of this conversation.
You're welcome. I've enjoyed your first few podcasts with Scott and Sean Palmer, and so I'm looking forward to seeing the other conversations and hearing what you guys talk about.
Well, thanks, man. This one I think should be good. Next week we have Richard Beck on, so I'm excited about that one as well. And one of our listeners sent me a message last week after the one with Scott posted, and he said, "Luke, you introduced him as Mr. Scott McKnight, not Dr. Scott McKnight." And I feel like I made that same mistake with you, because you were actually Dr. Joshua Graves, and I didn't introduce you properly, so I apologize for that. Do you feel disrespected?
No, not at all.
Good, good. Well, your doctoral work was talking about this very subject of Christianity and Islam and how they relate to each other in North America. Mm-hmm. Now, before we really jump into this subject, I think we probably need to lay some foundation work here, because I don't know how many people actually have much information about the basic religion of Islam. So if you wouldn't mind, just take a few minutes and kind of introduce us to kind of some of the core building blocks for this religion.
Sure. And I would encourage your listeners to certainly pursue their own, because I'm certainly not an expert. I'm not a Muslim. Despite what some people said after they read what I wrote, I'm a Christian. I'm very, very happy being a Christian. I just happen to think that we shouldn't kill Muslims. So I think in order to not kill someone, you have to try and understand them first.
That's a good premise.
So the basic tenets of Islam, as I understand it, and there have been all kinds of introductory works written, but the basic premise of Islam is submission and reverence for God.
Okay.
Muslims believe in they're monotheists like Jews and Christians. So they believe in a creator God who sustains the world through providence, through relationships, through ethics, through teachings, through communities of people on earth to help with human flourishing. They are very much a text-centered religion. In fact, in many ways, they're more of a text-centered religion than Christianity started out or Christianity should be. Their primary understanding of God's self-revelation or self-disclosure to the world is through the teachings of the Quran. They believe that the Quran was given to the Prophet Muhammad, and that these writings, these visions, these edicts, these ethical kind of guidelines are straight from the heart and the mind of God for people who desire to please or to submit their lives in reverence to God. So right away you see kind of a difference between Islam and Christianity, which we'll talk more about later. But Christianity is not primarily a text-centered religion. We're certainly a text-supported movement, a text-supported religion. But Christianity is inherently a person-driven movement, the life, the ethic, the resurrection of Jesus. Whereas Muslims are very much text-centered. They do not appreciate comparisons necessarily between Jesus and Muhammad, because they believe that they say something about Muhammad that we do not say about Jesus, and vice versa, that we say things about Jesus that they would not be comfortable with saying about Islam or the Quran or Muhammad. So their basic tenets are that life is kind of a mystical union with God, that life is about pursuing some kind of relationship with God. And the primary way, these are called the five pillars, the primary way one encounters God, shows reverence for God, experiences God in family life is through confession that God is God and there is no other God but God, that God's people are called to give, and that giving needs to be tied in some form or fashion to the poor, much like almsgiving in the Christian tradition. They believe in consistent daily efforts of prayer to create the space for God in their life. They believe in fasting. Obviously, the major holiday of Ramadan is connected to intentional sunup to sundown fasting. We even have professional athletes down in the United States who are Muslims who are somehow still functioning at a high level while they are participating in Ramadan. And then the final pillar is Hajj, the travel to Mecca, which became very well known in America when Malcolm X made his pilgrimage to Mecca, and that pilgrimage was the thing that kind of took him out of what I would call fundamentalist Islam, the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, into a much more robust picture. So what's really significant is Christians and Muslims make up half the world's population. Islam is not a Middle Eastern religion any more than Christianity is. Now, obviously, there's a significant portion of Muslims who live in the Middle East, but Islam is an international religion. Over 1.3, 1.4 billion Muslims live around the world. The majority of Muslims are not Arabic-speaking Middle Eastern-living people. The majority of Muslims live outside of the Middle East. So this is truly an international religion. And when you couple that with Christianity, again, if you have about 7 billion people living on planet Earth, half of the world identifies as either Christian or Muslim. So this is one of the big questions for the next 100 years, both in the United States, but especially globally, is can Christians and Muslims learn to, we may not be able to coexist, but can we try not to kill each other? And this is one of the three or four probably most important questions of the 21st century.
Yeah, that's definitely a very important question. Now, when we're talking about Islam, it probably wouldn't be fair to say that there's just one group. There obviously are different sections in Islam, with the main, main being the Sunnis and the Shiites. And then there's also the kind of the more mystical side of that.
Yeah, Sufi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so but the majority of Muslims today would be Sunnis, correct?
Yeah, you have Sunni is the largest branch, and you hear it anywhere estimated from 60% to 80%. I don't know the exact number, and I don't know if anyone, but it's very similar to Catholic Protestant, where Sunni emphasizes certain things regarding orthodoxy, Shia, and what gets really complicated in Islam, as opposed to say Western Christianity, is because of the horrible relationship between church and state in Western history, in many parts of Europe and the United and North America, there's this pretty clear division between church and state, at least in theory. Whereas Islam, because it's 600 years younger, you still see nations wrestling with the merger of church and state. So it gets really messy sometimes of understanding the difference between Sunni, Shia, and Sufi. Every major world religion has a mystical bent to it. You know, Christianity has it in St. Francis or Julian of Norwich or whatever. Islamic Sufis have Rumi. The Baha'is have, well, they're kind of mystical inherently, yeah, but they have their own kind of mystical bent to it. So, yeah, there's great diversity. And whenever I'm trying to, and what I do is try and be a bridge between Protestant Christians and my friends who are Muslim leaders. Whenever I'm in those conversations, I remind them that it's just like if someone were to ask you, well, what does Christianity teach about the Trinity? Well, if you ask a primitive Baptist or an ordained Anglican priest, you're probably going to get two different answers. Yeah. Now, hopefully they're generally in the same constellation together. Like, hopefully there's some common ground, but Islam is just as diverse as Christianity is. And it's so important to remember that moving forward, that we're dealing with primitive men who have been living in caves in Afghanistan, just like there have been times of primitive Christians, you know, who just lived to the land and were trying to survive. And you're dealing with University of Michigan graduates who are top neurosurgeons who work at Vanderbilt now. Yeah. So you're dealing with a wide array of religious, ethnic, and educational experiences that shape how you read text, shape how you think about the body, shape how you think about men and women in culture. So, yeah, it gets very complicated.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, especially your comparison to Protestant Catholics. I never even thought about that comparison, but it's probably pretty fitting. It's really difficult to just say an entire group of people holds all these beliefs. But the center of Islam is a monotheism, correct?
Yeah. Yes, they would be called, you know, whereas Jews and Muslims are strict monotheists, Christians are, I always say, we're monotheists, but like on Facebook, it's complicated.
Yeah, exactly.
We're complicated monotheists because we have to do the whole Father, Son, Spirit. And I think you're going to talk about this a little bit, but the best look at this for your listeners who are interested is Miroslav Volf's book, Allah, where he really takes on monotheism and shows that Muslims really are monotheistic in the same sense that Christians and Jews are. Things get muddled through translation, Allah versus Jehovah or Allah versus Yahweh. And we clearly are three different religions, but we are all Abrahamic. We are all rooted out of the story of one creator God.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think his book and what he's arguing for is obviously going to make a lot of people uncomfortable, but it's hopefully going to bring some conversations that need to happen. Right.
In terms of when I wrote my dissertation work at Columbia Seminary, that was kind of the book that solidified for me the need for this conversation to be projected into Nashville, Atlanta, Dallas, Chicago, you know, for church leaders. Your first year, the way it works at Columbia, your first year, they really push you to think about what you want to write on. And my simple passion was I wanted to write on something that could keep me up at night. When it was 11 o'clock and I wanted to quit, I wanted my heart to pump a little bit. I wanted the blood to flow a little faster through my veins. So when Volf's book came out, I was already 2 years into my research, but Volf's book is probably the single most important book on Jews, Christians, and Muslims for North Americans. Probably the most significant book written in the last 20 years because it's so clear and it's so particular linguistically of the false arguments and the false debates and how complex we read our histories and all the power games that are wrapped up into those conversations.
Yeah, let me read you one of the quotes that Volf said on the subject. He said, "Whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God is also the driving question for the relation between these two religions globally. Does the one God of Islam stand in contrast to the three personal God of Christianity, Does the Muslim God issue fierce, unbending laws and demand submission, whereas the Christian God stands for love, equal dignity, and the right of every individual to be different? Answer these questions one way, and you have a justification for cultural and military wars. Answer them the other way, and you have a foundation for a shared future marked by peace rather than violence. What do you think he means by that?
Well, I think he's going back to Genesis and Isaac and Ishmael. And I wish we had more time, and there's so much other stuff I want to get to. I don't want to belabor the point, but God's blessing was not just for Isaac. And this gets into, you know, especially for evangelicals, this gets very uncomfortable. But first of all, Ishmael is grossly mistreated in the story. There's injustice, and Hagar is certainly mistreated, and God, you know, we've done these weird translations with he'll be a wild ass of a man, and we've said he's cursed, and some like the stuff we've done in America with whites and blacks and rereading Genesis stories. But now clearly God is still the God of Ishmael, and he's going to primarily identify in history as the God of Isaac, but Ishmael is still part of the story. And so I think he's referring back to kind of our deeper narratives. And this is what's great about early Genesis. Early Genesis is not a Jewish, a Muslim, or a Christian book. Now, if anybody has the right to claim it, obviously it's Jews. Yep. Because they're the ones who preserve the stories and take it from oral tradition. But, for instance, Abraham is not a Jew. Abraham's not the first Jew. In terms of the strict biological DNA sense of how we think about Judaism and Israel, Abraham is this person who's taken from Ur of Chaldea, one of the largest cities at that time of the world. Mm-hmm. And out of Abraham comes the people of God in Israel. But Abraham is the one who, because he responds to the call of God. So Wolf does a masterful job of calling us back to the early parts of our sacred narratives. And of course, it gets really complex then when you add intertestamental period and Christian writings and what should be in Torah and what shouldn't be. And then you have the Quran and you have the Hadith and you have all of, and it gets really complicated. But he takes us back and says, you know, fundamental things about being made in the image of God. Yeah. And God makes covenant with his people, and he expects something. I also want to point out, too, maybe the second most important book, and this is a totally biased statement, is Lee Camp's book, Who is My Enemy? And Lee Camp is obviously from an Anabaptist perspective. He grew up in Churches of Christ. He is a member of Otter Creek Church. So, again, I'm being totally subjective on this, but his book has generated incredible conversation about what is the Anabaptist response to a culture of violence as it relates to Christians and Muslims trying to live in the 21st century? So for people who are very interested in the violence piece of it, and particularly just one community responding to another community, one person responding to another person, Lee Camp's is probably the most personal, pastoral look at what it looks like to be a Christian who takes the Sermon on the Mount seriously as it relates to Muslims, both here in the United States and around the world. It's a compelling
book. Since he is a member of the church, which you're the preacher for, do you get a cut of that book sales?
No, I don't even get tickets to his now famous radio
show. Oh, well, that's a shame. That is a real shame. Okay, now, in your book, Tearing Down the Walls, your argument for how our relationship with Islam should function seems to be based out of two things. One, the Good Samaritan story, and two, the image of God. And first and foremost, did you get points deducted on your final paper because you kept referring to it as the Merciful Samaritan when we all know the story is called the Good Samaritan?
Yeah. So someone like 50 years ago in a translation committee put that title in there and it stuck.
No, right? I mean it's the right answer. So regardless, you put the that as a centerpiece for how you understand.
Now you sound like you're hosting a talk show, like we're gonna have live callers.
Maybe.
You just went a little Rush Limbaugh on me. I like that.
You're never getting invited back after that. No, never again.
The reason I did – okay, I better make this a good one. Yeah, you did. This is my last one. The reason I did that is, you know, inductively, as you read the narrative, the whole punchline of Luke 10 is centered around the Jewish lawyer's inability to answer Jesus's question at the story. He can't even say the Muslim. He can't even say it was the Samaritan when Jesus asks. All he can say is the one who showed mercy.
And the question being, who was the neighbor at the end of the story?
Who was the neighbor? Yeah. He can't let Samaritan fall from his lips.
You have an interesting note in your book, which you kind of might have did a Freudian slip there when you referred to him as the good Muslim.
No, that was intentional. I try to use it interchangeably.
And explain why you do that.
Oh, man. Okay, well, let's just go back. Let's go back to parables in general. Okay. So parables, Jesus doesn't invent parables. Parables are a subset of a Jewish teaching strategy called the Mashal. M-A-S-H-A-L, the Mashal. So Mashals are like riddles. Mm-hmm. And you know, even rabbis do this today. Like, they understand that riddles or jokes draw people in and make them think about what you're trying to say in a way that's different than, here are my 3 points, or here's the answer, now go memorize it. So the classic example, right, is Nathan going to David in the Old Testament when he creates this mashal, he creates this riddle, this parable. So Jesus enters into a rabbinic world in the first century in which, and there's all kinds of evidence of this, other rabbis use riddles. You know, Hillel and Gamaliel use riddles and mashals all the time. But what Jesus does is, I think, he perfects... if I could use a gross U2, I mean, U2 couldn't do what they do without the Beatles, but the Beatles could not do what U2 does because it was just a different time or a different era. U2 couldn't do what U2 did without Bob mm-hmm. Dylan. So what Jesus does is, he comes from this long tradition of incredible storytellers, of these rabbis who teach with the Mashal. So the parable is supposed to be this sneaky, subversive form of communication, which really, honestly, enrages mm-hmm. people. And that's why, you know, Jesus is really good at it, because his parables, they confuse and they make people mad. And the reason they do that is, he's causing them, as Emily Dickinson would say, to see the world on a slant. Yeah. He's causing them to have their trajectory or their orientation. So with the Good Samaritan, everything is set up in the story to turn your head around on a swivel, to literally make you see the world kind of upside down. And if I could, I'll try and do this very quickly, but my research focused on how is the Good Samaritan story interpreted in North American Christianity. Yep. You know, it was just too big to look at the international scene. So all I was after in my research was, I want to know how this parable is interpreted in North American Protestant churches. And I wanted to see, do those interpretations line up with Jesus? Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's what I found. And this is the really long answer to your question. What I found is that there are 4 layers, like peeling an onion. There are 4 levels to the story. The first layer is what you see every night on the local news. And that is, be a good person. Like, if you see someone on the side of the road who has a flat tire, it's always good to do good. You know, jerks are jerks. We don't need a culture of jerks. Let's be nice. Let's get along. So almost every week you have a story in the local news of a Good Samaritan. President Obama, President Bush, they have, I don't know if it's every month or how often, but they honor what's called the Good Samaritan Award, and it's for someone who helps someone else. So that's kind of the first layer of, and again, I'm assuming your audience knows this story. The second layer, and this is where it gets really interesting, this is kind of the Billy Graham layer. And this is, and by the way, I believe the presuppositions that are necessary in order to do this interpretation are false, but it's still intriguing. The Billy Graham layer is that we choose love over the law. And this is very much a Protestant reading. The Protestant reading says, the reason why the religious figures could not help the Jew who had been beat up is because they weren't allowed to become unclean. Mm-hmm. Now, the text that they look at to support that from the Old Testament all hinge on the guy being dead. Mm-hmm. We know the guy is not being dead. We could quibble whether they thought he was dead or he appeared to be dead, you know, was perceived to be dead, so they are invoking the Levitical purity laws. But clearly the guy's not that, but in this second interpretation, you always choose love over law. So if there's a law in the United States that exists in a way that would cause you to do something that is not loving someone, then you choose the love over the law. And this is kind of evangelical Max Lucado, grace over works, grace over the law. That's how that story gets played out, and it's a very helpful interpretation. But it really gets interesting when you get to the bottom two layers. The third layer is the reason Martin Luther King, arguably, is the most important voice in American history. Because Martin Luther King came along and said that justice is love made public. See, King said, I want to know why the Jericho Road is dangerous in the first place. And so he made it this kind of communal, societal, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are equal, created equal with certain inalienable rights. And so he said, hey, we got that because of our Judeo-Christian heritage that challenged societal norms where people could get beat up and could be left for dead. And so he really went after the justice layer and made that a justice text and a compassion text, and love can't be private. Love can't just be what you do in your home between you and God. The love has to be, you know, on display for the world to see, which is obviously part of his ethic of nonviolence. Okay, so for me, it became intensely personal. As I'm doing the research, I feel good about all of that, and I'm very lucky in Nashville that one of the foremost New Testament scholars in the world lives 15 minutes from me. Her name is Amy Jill Levine. She is a Jewish scholar who teaches New Testament at Vanderbilt Divinity. So I, through Amy Jill, Dr. Levine teaches twice a year or so at Otter Creek, and I had the luxury of being able to call her and say, can we break bread together, because I want to tell you about this project I'm working on. So she was very gracious, and I told her, you know, here's what I think's going on in the story, and this was her response. And this is like when reporters say, I knew I had a story. Like, this is when I knew I had a story. We were eating salsa and chips, and she said, Josh, those three interpretations are all great, and they're all true, and they all exist in North America, and we need to keep them. She said, the only problem is those aren't really in line with what Jesus actually meant in his context. Now, here's a Jew who is a scholar in the New Testament, particularly in Luke, telling me that there's a deeper Jewish understanding of the story. So here's what she said to me, and here's what I do in the book, what I do in my writing. And this is from a book that she wrote called The Misunderstood Jew. She's now published this. She said, what you have to do, and this is, I loved how you started this podcast, because this is exactly what you did in your beginning. She said, you have to put yourself in a ditch, or you have to put yourself on the edge of an interstate. You're on the margin, you know, you're on the side of the interstate, and you've had the crap beat out of you, or you've been in a horrible car accident. And by the way, if you're into movies, this is the movie Crash. The movie Crash is Luke 10. It's unbelievable how much Luke 10 is Crash and Crash is Luke 10. But A.J. Levine says you put yourself in the ditch on the side of the highway and you ask yourself two questions. Who's the person I would least desire to come and help me? More importantly, who's the person I least expect to come and help me? Because until you can name that person or those persons, you cannot understand why Jesus made the Samaritan the hero. Everyone in the story is a Jew. Jesus is a Jew. His audience are Jews. The guy who gets beat up is a Jew. The priests and the Levites and the people who come along are Jews. But there's only one person who's not a Jew. And if you don't understand why he made a Samaritan the hero, it doesn't matter why you tell the story or how you tell the story. So she says, you put yourself in the ditch, and perhaps it's someone who molested you when you were 8, or perhaps it's your ex-husband, or perhaps it's Muslims, or, you know, for my grandfather's generation, perhaps it's those blacks, or it's, you know, SEC football fan. I don't, you know, for whoever it is for you, you put yourself in the ditch and you think, I can deal with these people, I can deal with these people, but I can't stand those people. Those people are dirty, scheming, you know, because her point is Jesus made the Samaritan the hero because he wanted Jews to realize that Samaritans were capable of living out the kingdom of God. And his whole mission is to bring the message to Gentiles too. And until they were able to see, to have the capacity of imagination, to believe that a Samaritan could embody the kingdom of God just as much as a Jew could, then they really couldn't see the God who created the whole world, the God who had made everyone in God's image. So you put yourself in the ditch. The doorbell rings, and your daughter's having someone over for dinner. And it's a Muslim, you know, or it's whatever it is. And that's when you understand the historical weight of what Jesus was trying to do.
So the significance of the Good Samaritan story really is the ethic it calls for us to live out as neighbors. And since Christianity and Islam make up basically half the world, there's a good chance that one of our neighbors is going to be a Muslim. And so you're arguing that it's not about our common ground, but it's really our call from Jesus that calls us to be good neighbors.
Great. Yeah, that's a great question. So this is what's happened in the 20th century, as I understand it. You essentially had mainline liberals who said, you know, these are liberal Methodists, Presbyterians, UCC. These are all the people I went to school with at Columbia, and they're beautiful people, but essentially the move, the interfaith move, was we're all traveling up the same mountain, we're just taking different paths.
Yeah.
So let's get together and find our commonalities, which, you know, is not a bad thing. That's a beautiful thing. Meanwhile, in Protestant evangelical, it was fear, it was isolation, it was, so while the liberals were saying we're all the same, conservative evangelicals were saying we're so different we can't even talk, we're just going to isolate, we're going to be separated. So what we've started to see early 1990s and especially post 9/11 is within the Protestant and somewhat in the Catholic world, but within Protestant liberalism and evangelicalism, you have this third way movement that's saying we're not the same. Christians and Muslims are not the same. They're a Quranic driven religion. We're a Jesus resurrection driven movement. Those are fundamentally different. But let's agree not to kill each other. Let's talk about our similarities. Let's talk about our differences. And let's trust that in the fullness of time, the best thing to do is to present a compelling Christianity and a compelling Islam that is good for the world. Kwame Bediako, one of the leading scholars in Africa, he has this great line. He says that the chief, I'm going to paraphrase, but he says the chief task of the church is whether or not the church can be good news for people who do not subscribe to the Christian faith. Hmm. What he's saying, because he's in Africa, the major collision point for Islam and Christianity right now, especially in places like Sudan, he's saying, can Christianity promise on the inherent gift of the Gospels that Jesus is good news for everybody, not just for those who believe in Jesus? So when you see hospitals in India, when you see orphanages in Africa, when you see these things, you see that as crazy as our history is and as many skeletons as we have as Christians, we also have a lot to really be proud of. We have a lot to say, yes, but in Jesus' name, we've done these beautiful things for people who are not subscribers of Christianity. Like you'd subscribe to a magazine, you know. So that's kind of the chief path ahead. And that's where Evolve and the Lee Camps and the Krista Tippetts and the Barbara Brown Taylors and some others are saying, don't – I'm going to act like my friend Amir Iran, who is the chief theologian for the Nashville Islamic Center. We joke all the time when we're together having lunch. Like, I want him to become a Jesus person. He wants me to become a Quran person, a Quranic disciple. But I expect him to be the best Muslim he can be and not apologize. And he expects me to be the best Christian I can be. And we've agreed that we're going to let God sort this out in the end. because God's going to, whether we want to, that to happen or not. But at the end, as Philippians 2 says, right, from a Christian perspective, every knee's going to bow, every tongue's going to confess, and we'll let God sort this out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. You have this great line in your book, because engaging our Muslim neighbor is not just about Muslims. It's about Christians becoming the people God dreams for us to be. I love that. It's a beautiful picture that what we're called to do in engaging our neighbors, whatever religion or ethnicity they come from, it's really ultimately not about them. It's about the way of Jesus that God has called us to. Right. Now, you start off your book with this the statement about the stories we tell ourselves. We are the stories we tell ourselves. Yeah. And so as we wrap up here, what's a better story that we can tell ourselves about our neighbors who are from an Islam faith? What can we tell ourselves a better story than what we see from 9/11? What's a better way to understand it than the characters that have dominated our understanding of the entire religion of Islam?
Yeah, that's a great question. That quote comes from a Flannery O'Connor interview in which she says it takes a story to make a story. Mm-hmm. We are the stories we tell ourselves. So I'm going to answer your question with a story, if that's okay, in good rabbinic fashion. Last week I spoke in East Nashville, which is one of the most diverse sections of Nashville. I spoke to a pretty diverse group of students on this subject that we're talking about, the book, Tearing Down the Walls. They asked me to come and talk about it. And so I put on Instagram my just a simple outline I'd written in my little journal of what I was going to talk about. And another Christian minister, another Christian pastor responded to my line that I believe Christians should not kill Muslims. His response was, yeah, but what about Muslims who kill Christians? Now, here's what I want to say. That's an important conversation. Al-Qaeda is real. Like, the Taliban is real. Like, the right-wing fundamentalist, hell-bent, violence-driven wing of Islam is serious in Afghanistan and Iraq and places, parts of Africa. But my fundamental message right now is trying to convince Christians that we've got to be Christian, that we are called to be Christian, especially when other people aren't living the best of their faith. So what's happened in Christianity is people have said, basically, it's like what seven-year-olds say, well, if he's not going to do it, I'm not going to do it. Like, no, when other people are at their worst, that's when Christians are supposed to be at our best. That's the whole essence of the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus says, what credit is to you that you love people who love you back or you love your friends? The real test of authentic humanity, according to the kingdom of God, is can you love people when they deserve it the least? And Jesus is cross-shaped, right? And so he shows us that love is public action with the body willing to suffer on behalf of enemies and strangers. And this is what has separated, in my opinion, Christianity from other religions. So, you know, this is the climate we live in. This is the day we live in. But I would love to have dialogue with people. The book's called Tearing Down the Walls. You can get it on Amazon. I would love to hear from people. I've gotten some really interesting response, mostly from pastors and other church leaders. But I wrote it in such a way that I think soccer moms and anybody can get a handle of what I'm trying to get.
That's great. And they can contact you, obviously, through Facebook. You're on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And you're very available in both of those forums, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, Josh, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate you coming on the show, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Luke. You're doing a good work. I look forward to other shows that you record, especially since this was my last one.
We'll see about that. Thanks, man.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.